On the programme, A Dreamer in Belfast, the life and work of playwright Stuart Parker. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight.
Well, I'm caught one more time up on Cypress Avenue. I'm caught one more time up on Cypress Avenue. And I'm conquered in a car seat. Nothing that I can do. I may go crazy.
Van Morrison there evoking his native city of Belfast. And tonight we look at the work and life of a man sometimes described as the Van Morrison of theatre, Belfast playwright Stuart Parker. A fine new book, Stuart Parker, A Life, by Marilyn Richterick, provides many significant insights into Parker's writing life and the literary, social and political life of Belfast from his childhood in the 1940s through the turbulent decades up to his early death in 1988 at the age of 47. Parker remembered and celebrated for plays like Spokesong and his trilogy of plays for Ireland, Northern Star, Heavenly Bodies and Pentecost, and for striking and original television plays like I'm a Dreamer, Montreal and Iris in the Traffic, Ruby in the Rain. His was a singular and rich voice in Irish theatre, and here is his voice, Stuart Parker speaking after an evening in the Ardoin Theatre in Enniskillen, where writers remembered those killed in the IRA Remembrance Day bomb attack of November 1987.
I came to join with my fellow writers in an expression of solidarity, in an expression, an assertion of artistic values against the forces of destruction and negativism, which are the concerns that we're all trying to speak to in this particular culture. It made me feel good about the fact that I was a writer, because a lot of the time as a writer you feel isolated and helpless. You're creating an entertainment, if you're a playwright, for the public in your own room. And what you write tends to be very evanescent. It comes and people either go to it or they don't, and it disappears, and that's that. And to get together with your fellow writers on an occasion like this and feel that sense of shared grief and shared assertion of those creative values that I was talking about earlier is a very encouraging and uplifting experience.
Stuart Parker there speaking after an evening in the Ardoin Theatre in Enniskillen, where writers remembered those killed in the IRA Remembrance Day bomb attack of November 1987. We'll be talking to biographer Marilyn Richterick shortly, and later to Stuart Parker's niece, theatre director Lynn Parker of Rough Magic, and Gerald Daw of Trinity College, editor of a number of books on and of Parker's writing. Since his death, the Stuart Parker Trust has honoured the playwright's name and legacy with an annual award in his name. More on that later. Here, John Fairley of the Trust remembers Stuart Parker.
Well, we first knew one another. We were undergraduates together at Queen's in the 1960s. But I think that the characteristic of Stuart people most remember and you think of him is kind of a chuckle. I mean, whatever was happening, I mean, no matter how grim it might be in substance, Stuart would always see something amusing in it and turn it into a kind of a joke. And he was great at deflating pomposity in his friends. You had to be very careful when you were talking, because you'd find he was mimicking you and sending you up. If he was saying something very pompous or pretentious, he would carry on and exaggerate it. You realize that you were being absolutely hung out to dry. And actually, one of my first rather odd memories is of sitting at lunchtime in the university canteen with some friends, and Stuart was in hospital and he was having a leg amputated. He had cancer when he was 19 or 20, and we were all sitting very gloomily and wondering how he was, and you know, just feeling quite overshadowed by the whole event. But of course, he survived that, and he was quite phlegmatic about it and quite amusing about it. I remember him saying, "Good heavens, you know, I'm only 20, but a quarter of me is gone already." So he just got on with it, and he was always amused by people's reactions. I mean, I remember him saying that there was one young lady he was chatting to, or even chatting up, and she fondly started putting her hand on his knee, only it was his artificial knee, and he found this very amusing. He didn't quite know when to broach the fact that, you know, that there was some misunderstanding. So, I mean, it was always a source of fun. You know, I suppose, what else can you do with such an event early in your life? But after Queen's, Stuart went off to America, to Cornell, and I went off to England to university for different kind of postgraduate work that we were both doing. And then we happened to come back to Belfast together, just coincidentally, in 1970. And that time I was teaching at Queen's, and Stuart was trying to make a living as a freelance journalist. He was writing a column for the Irish Times on pop music, and he was writing scripts for the BBC. But all the time he was concentrating on trying to put together his first play, which after about 5 years in the mid-70s became Spokesong, his first major success.
John Fairley there of the Stuart Parker Trust. Marilyn Richterick, what started your interest in Stuart Parker and his work?
Well, I was doing graduate research at Oxford University on the Field Day Theatre Company. So I first heard of Stuart Parker in connection with Field Day, since they had produced his last play, Pentecost. And it was on my very first trip to Belfast to do the Field Day research, or start the Field Day research, that his play Spokesong happened to be on at the Lyric. This was in 1989. And I found out later, much to my astonishment, that this was the first local production that Spokesong had received. Despite the fact that by then, you know, this is the year after he died, Spokesong had been seen all over the world. There was a time in the mid-70s when it was one of the most widely produced plays in the United States, for example. So it took a while for it to be done in Belfast, but I was fortunate to see that production, and I just fell in love with it. It was so theatrical, so utterly unexpected. It blew me away. And that's what really sparked my interest. You know, then I started reading everything that I could find. A lot of it wasn't published at that time, but that's what really got my interest started.
Bring us back, if you would, to his childhood and upbringing. Born in 1941, and there's a fascinating quote in your book where he seems almost to remember Belfast life before he was born.
Well, I'd say that the Belfast that he was born into in 1941 was largely a Victorian city still. You know, it was still a time where his older brother tells me, and his older brother is an engineer and would remember these kinds of things. You know, he said in a working class area like the one where they grew up in Sydenham, there weren't a lot of private cars. You know, a lot of the work of tradesmen was still done with horse and wagon. People bringing things around, you know, selling coal door to door and all kinds of other things door to door. It was, you know, most of the buildings dated from Victorian times, that red brick. And you could still see, you know, just green hills all around. So it was a place that hadn't changed tremendously from a century before, although it changed a lot, you know, shortly after that. So there was that. And he talks about, you know, the experience of the Belfast Blitz. I mean, his mother was pregnant with him at the time. And he talks about this event as kind of being a formative event for him. And I think that was a perspective he developed a little bit later, maybe at university, that his generation was the war generation, or immediate pre-war, or post-war, rather, generation. He was very conscious as a young man of growing up under that shadow of nuclear annihilation.
How staunchly loyalist was his background?
Not very. I mean, his family was quite liberal, really. You know, he had a grandfather and an uncle who were, you know, kind of orange men, but his family that he grew up in was not very politically inclined. They were much more interested in music.
as of course he himself came to be as well, and we'll talk later in the programme about his music columns for the Irish Times, and of course music running through so much of his theatre work as well. But you'd mentioned there, you know, the move to university, going to Queen's, studying poetry, and the Belfast Writers Group, this an important presence in Queen's in his early days, lecturer Philip Hobsbawm, and gathering around him this, I suppose, a kind of literary clique, Parker amongst them. How significant and formative was that time?
Well, I think it was very formative. I mean, most of the writers who are involved with it will tell you that, you know, what the great value of it really was giving these young writers a sense of an audience eager to hear what they had to say. You know, they wrote, you know, they were presenting work to each other, and that idea that people cared about what you had to say and that what you had to say about this place at this time was important. I think Hobsbawm was good at giving them that sense that, you know, my personal experience is important. Northern Ireland was not a place that I think any of them thought of as having a great literary tradition at that time. You know, it does have one, but they weren't particularly focused on that, most of them. But I think he gave them that sense. And also just as a spur to write, you know, you had a slot, you had a date that you were supposed to produce some work, you produced some work. So it was very useful in that sense.
And of course, Parker did write poetry, and it was published. How would you describe his poetry, and how does it link to the plays?
I'm not sure I see a huge amount of continuity between the poetry and the plays. His poetry was pretty confessional at that time, like I guess a lot of young people's poetry is. And, you know, some people commented at the time that it seemed very preoccupied with death and deformation and aging. And I think a lot of that is attributable to the fact that he lost a leg to cancer when he was 19. So he was very preoccupied with death in a way that people who knew him often found odd, because he was so humorous, so gregarious, so much fun to be around. People tended to forget almost that, if they ever knew, that he'd had that brush with death at such a young age.
Parker then had spent some time in the States at the height of the civil rights struggle of the 1960s, teaching at Cornell. And I think that it's fair to say that that helped to shape his politics. Returning to Belfast then in 69, to the height of the turn of events there, when did he become serious about being a playwright or writing plays?
Well, he was thinking of writing plays there, you know, from the mid to late 60s. He was writing radio drama. He had a lot of experience at school and at university in, you know, theater, and he was always interested in that, but it was just one of many things he was interested in. It was the mid-70s, about 1975. it was 1975 when he decided, okay, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to be, a playwright. And the catalyst for that was a play that he wrote for the BBC called The Iceberg, which was about Titanic. More specifically, it was about two Belfast shipyard workers who were killed during the building of Titanic and ended up sort of coming along on the maiden voyage as ghosts. And they're the main characters in the play. And this, he got to know a young drama producer in Belfast, Michael Heffernan, and they became good friends. And that was really, he had the sense that, okay, this is really what I want to do. So his first stage play, Spoke Song, was directed by Michael Heffernan too.
Of course, in Dublin. But interestingly as well, you know, Parker described Northern Ireland and life in Northern Ireland as being almost in a kind of no man's land. And I suppose, in a sense, theatre in Belfast and in the North could almost be described as existing in a similar kind of limbo. And he did, it's interesting that he didn't have a great deal of time, for instance, for the Lyric Theatre, which was, of course, a powerhouse in his day, in his early career.
Well, it was a powerhouse in the sense that it was the only theater that remained open throughout the Troubles. Most theaters in Belfast had closed by 1971 because of the violence. People didn't want to go out at night. It was dangerous. So it was really a very difficult place to try to launch a playwriting career. And compounded in his case by the fact that the Lyric, which was, as I said, the only producing theater through this much of this period, was run by people who didn't have a whole lot of interest in producing local work or new work. So, you know, that was sort of two strikes against him there, and which meant that his early plays were produced primarily in Dublin, at the Theatre Festival, at the Peacock, and in Britain, too. There was a company in Birmingham, the Birmingham Repertory Company did several of... They produced the first production of Heavenly Bodies, and they also did some of his other plays. So he had relationships outside Northern Ireland, but it wasn't till the mid-80s that his work really started to be done in Northern Ireland, even though almost all of it is about Northern Ireland.
Of course, along with Spoke Song, the stage plays he's remembered for, best remembered for, would be Northern Star, Heavenly Bodies, and Pentecost, his last stage play. Very different works, and I suppose many people may not have had a chance to see them because really they're not done often enough. But the strong sense of history colouring the present is in all of the plays, yet to call them history plays seems inadequate.
Well, I think the great truth that you get at when you look at work like his is the great truth of Northern Ireland, or Ireland, or maybe any place, is that history is not just about the past. History is about the present and the future, too. You have the past, which is just the sum total of everything that's ever happened, and then you have history, which is, you know, narratives about the past. And what people choose to remember and how they choose to remember it is very important in shaping what will happen in the future. And I think that's why writers are so important in a place like Northern Ireland that is, you know, in the time when Parker was writing, was going through a period of political turmoil. I think he understood the political potential of theater to get people to see things they might not have seen before or think about things they thought they knew in a different way. Henry Joy McCracken, the main character in Northern Star, who's a historical figure, was one of the leaders of the 1798 rebellion, is talking about Northern Ireland and his fiancé, girlfriend, whatever, says, you know, people, they don't forget anything here. And he said, no, it's far worse than that. They misremember everything.
Let's hear Eleanor Methuen reading from Stuart Parker's last play, Pentecost.
I sinned against my own flesh in lust and fornication. I had to desert my own baby. Nobody ever knew. Only the Lord our God knew, and his eye was on me all right, burning into the very soul of me. He alone was witness to the torment that I have suffered every living hour in this house, where the very walls and doors cry out against me. There was never anybody to tell the knife that went through me a dozen times a day, minding how I left my child, walking away from him, leaving him bundled up there in that wooden box. Nobody to help me, only me here in this house, gnawing and tearing away at my own heart and lights until I was all consumed by my own wickedness on the inside. Nothing left but the shell off me, for appearance's sake. Still and all, at least I never let myself down. Never cracked. Never surrendered. Not one inch. I went to my grave a respectable woman, Mrs. Alfred George Matthews. I never betrayed him. That was the way I atoned, you see. I done him proud. He never knew any reason to be ashamed of me or doubt my loyalty from the day we married to the day I went to my grave. Alan. He came from across the water, you see. There was a picture in my Bible at Sunday school, the fair-skinned archangel standing at the gates of heaven. That's what he looked like. Only he was a dark angel. Angel of death. Agent of Satan. He swept me up. High up. Took me up into the sky. And then he dropped me. Left me. Flew home. Left me falling. Fallen.
From Stuart Parker's play Pentecost, Eleanor Methuen there. Marlon Richtrick, as one observation in your book that I was very struck by, you say that despite the humour pervading his work and the apparent naturalism of the dialogue, a tragic vision lies at the heart of Parker's enduring achievement. What do you think, I suppose, affected and defined that vision? Was it in part his own illness that you referred to earlier, that shadow constantly at his shoulder from an early age?
Well, that was certainly part of it, I think, you know, that awareness. I mean, I think it's also what made him live more fully, is that knowing that life is for everyone, you know, a temporary thing. I think he had that burned into his being. And I think also the experience of growing up in Northern Ireland and living in it through that particular time, you know, writing in it through the period of the Troubles. And, you know, he died before the peace process really got started. So I think that obviously is part of it. You know, the feeling that Henry Joy McCracken expresses near the end of Northern Star. You know, this love for a place that you see kind of self-destructing. You know, we can't love it for what it is, only for what it might have been, if we'd gotten it right.
Or what it might be. How do you see Stuart Parker's place now in the context of modern Irish theatre? You know, he's never going to be as popular or performed as people like Brian Friel or Tom Murphy, yet he has left this very strong mark that will endure.
Well, one reason I wrote the book was that I would like to see his plays. I'd like to see them myself more often. I've had the fortune to see a few of his plays on stage, but that's really where a playwright's words belong. And his plays are so good. I just think they should be a lot more popular than they are. And one thing I hope the book would do is make people want to see them and make people want to produce them. So I hope that he will become more popular. He's very funny, very profound. He has important things to say. And he wrote real plays, you know, with lots of characters with different points of view interacting and arguing. I mean, it's great. It's great stuff.
as indeed is the book. Marlon Richterich, thank you so much indeed. And Stuart Parker, A Life by Marlon Richterich, is published by Oxford University Press. Well, we've heard from John Fairley of the Stuart Parker Trust already, which since Parker's death has awarded a bursary, currently £8,000 sterling, to a new playwright in the year of their first professional production. The most recent award winner of this bursary is Nancy Harris for her play No Romance. Separately, Paul Mercier won a Parker Trust BBC Irish Language Award for his play Satanta. We'll hear from both of them in a moment, but first John Fairley again on how the Trust came about.
It was very poignant. It's always, I mean, it was horrific that a friend should die so young, but also the added element of here was a talent which was just, you know, developing into something very mature. His last play, Pentecost, you know, was set in Belfast, and it had a kind of spiritual quality to it. I mean, he wasn't a religious person in any conventional sense. But it was about some people just coming together and living in a derelict house on the Peace Line in Belfast. And, you know, through that interaction, you know, so much was explored backwards into the elements of why Belfast and Northern Ireland was in such an extraordinary situation of conflict. And it was a very heartfelt piece, and one felt that his writing was not maturing but developing into something beyond the rather playful elements in his earlier work. And even I think the London premiere of the play was after he died, so it was particularly sad. And friends are in a state of shock, and sometimes you feel so odd and useless. And we just got a bit of energy amongst some of the friends. We decided that as Stuart had had such a tough time early in his career trying to get his plays even read and produced in theatre, and that the playwright, you know, had this particular struggle to break into the theatre world in Ireland at that time, we thought we'd set up a trust in his name to encourage other writers through that sort of block and over that threshold into professional theatre. And then friends of his who were already eminent, active in theatre, like Stephen Ray and Seamus Heaney, Frank McGuinness, Jennifer Johnson, Brian Friel, agreed to become trustees. And within days of his death, in a kind of frantic way that you do at a time of tragedy, you know, this energy, we just were in a rather odd sort of way, throwing ourselves into organising the trust and raising money for it and deciding what we're going to do. And within the first few weeks, we got some money from the BBC to set up the first award, which we then looked around and we wondered where was the emerging talent in theatre in Ireland. And we came upon Sebastian Barry, and we gave him the very first award very soon after Stuart died. I don't know how Stuart would have felt about it. We sometimes felt a bit embarrassed. You know, we feel that he'd been making fun of us all rushing around and raising money and doing things in his name. And we felt it was a bit of a liberty we were taking by doing it in his name, because people soon began to talk about the Stuart Parker Awards and his name was kind of integrated into this. But I think it's quite appropriate that, you know, that whole layer of kind of energy, creativity in Irish theatre should be in some way honoured and associated with his name. So I think in the end it's okay. The friends, I think we can console ourselves that perhaps he wouldn't have minded too much.
Well, I'm Nancy Harris, and I was awarded the Stuart Parker Award in 2012 for my first professional production of a play, No Romance, at the Peacock Theatre. Well, it was a huge honour to receive it, and I think the award is probably, it's the only playwriting award that we have in Ireland that actually has money attached to it, and that is specifically only for playwriting. And I think it's an incredible thing, because implicit in the award is the understanding that there is no career path for a playwright, and that you're actually probably not even as good as your last play in one way, because you may be lucky enough to be recommissioned, as I was, by the Abbey, but there is actually never a guarantee of a production, even from a commission. And the Stuart Parker Award gives money to a playwright after seeing their first play, allowing them to write their second play and indeed their third play, without being beholden to anyone else and without having to look for a commission and without having to censor yourself in any way. Not that playwrights have to, but sometimes to get work, there just simply isn't enough commissions to go around. And what the Stuart Parker Award has given me is just a sense of freedom that I can kind of write from my heart and what I want to write about. And it doesn't matter if that subject is in fashion or in Vogue or in anything else, you can just write truthfully. And I think that's an incredible legacy for any playwright to leave other playwrights. But I think it's extraordinary to do that on a first play when you're really just learning your craft.
My name is Paul Mercier. Last year I received the Stuart Parker Irish Language Award for a play I did called Sitanta. Now, if you had told me that I was going to receive such an award with Stuart Parker's name on it and for an Irish language play, I would have laughed. But that's just the way these things work out sometimes. I'm not an Irish language dramatist. I wanted to write Sitanta for a company called Feebean, which is a puppet company here in Galway in Connemara. And they had commissioned me to write the play. And I was delighted to get the opportunity to do a reworking of the legend of the town and make it a contemporary story in Irish. And that's how I ended up getting the Stuart Parker Award. It's a terrific recognition, and it's extraordinary that such a recognition does come from this particular neck of the woods, given that it is Stuart Parker. I have to say, to my discredit, I saw him as a Northern playwright in a way. So I wasn't really experiencing his work until I saw Pentecost. And then I realised what I was missing. And what I learned then about the man was that he was a philosopher as well as he was a playwright. He had what I would describe as a rock and roll sensibility that worked itself into his plays. He was a man of great hope. He came from a divided society and one of those playwrights that was able to create unity or bring a sense of unity. Very brave writer, extraordinary. And I loved Pentecost. I just loved the whole dynamic of it, the whole sense of bringing these people together in this world that had partly magical and actually gave us a sense of how society could be in a time that was very, very dark indeed.
The play I'm most familiar with is actually his first play, Spoke Song, and I think it's just such an incredible play. It's very playful, it's very theatrical, it's very funny, it's very sad. But I think what's amazing about it is that he makes Belfast, which he always wrote about, both specific and universal. And I think that's an amazing quality to write about a historical moment or a political moment, and not to shy away from that, but also to make it something bigger, not just about Ireland, but about people. And there's a real humanity in Stuart Parker's work that I really admire.
Playwright Nancy Harris there. You're listening to Arts Tonight and this programme on the life and work of Stuart Parker. In a moment, Lynn Parker and Gerald Daw, but first, Owen Rowe with this extract from Parker's play Pratt's Fall, which explores some of his interest in the story of St. Brendan.
Think of it, 1400 years ago, those monks were living on the final precipice, the west coast of Ireland, the absolute edge of the known world. Every day, lifting their eyes across a great grey heaving desert of a sea, stretching to the very rim of the earth itself, an unknown cosmic turbulence. Imagine what it meant to cast yourself into that. No map, no compass, in a shell of stretched cowhide. The boat you can maybe reconstruct, but not the state of being, not the unconditional surrender to God's will, not the wild surge of faith or the rapture of it, the blind leap into the dark. That class of a voyage is no longer in the sea's gift.
Owen Rowe there with an extract from Stuart Parker's play Pratt's Fall. Joining me now in studio are Lynn Parker, Artistic Director of Rough Magic Theatre Company, and Stuart Parker's niece, and Gerald Daw, co-editor of a number of collections of Parker's critical and cultural writing, including High Pop, the music columns for the Irish Times. Lynn, tell me when you first became aware of Stuart Parker, the playwright, and what effect did seeing his work have on you?
Well, I was aware from a very, very young age because he used to write plays for Christmas for me and my sister when we were children. called things like Snowy Whiteness and the Three Smallish Persons, because we were all very politically correct, but we had to do it amongst ourselves. So we were putting them on for our parents and grandparents, and they were original texts, and somewhere in my mother's collection we have these originals. I'll hook them out at some stage. But that was obviously just a game, really, for us as kids. And my first genuine awareness of him was when I was 14 and I came to Dublin with my aunt to see his first play, the first production of Spoke Song, which was in the Dublin Theatre Festival. And I had simply never seen anything like that before. It was so alive and playful and funny. And it was really an electric occasion because it was the hit of that year's festival. And that's when I got bitten, I would say, very strongly indeed.
And then later, I think you had a chance to see Stuart directing.
Well, oddly enough, yes. A lot of playwrights, when they are in charge of their own work, are a little bit inarticulate or find it difficult to get the idea across. They feel they've entirely expressed it in the writing. And during the first production of Pentecost for Field Day, I was lucky enough to be an observer in rehearsals. Patrick Mason was very kind and let me sit in. And he was away for a few days, and Stuart was taking rehearsals as they'd agreed, and it was fascinating to watch how completely open he was to the actors' needs. He was a very practical director. Things were expressed very clearly, and it was very, very enjoyable. He knew how to make a room fun, and I think that was another big lesson for me.
There's also that sense in the plays that he really knew what he was doing in terms of structure and theatricality, that sense of playfulness and playing with the play in what he was doing. And so he must have had a director's eye as well.
He had a very visual eye. I mean, he loved settings, and he loved the whole atmosphere of the theatre. And he was a great historian as well. And sometimes we do talk about his playfulness and the theatricality. And sometimes I think people slightly overlook the profound seriousness behind those plays. That when he was writing something like Spoke Song, which is a play with music and bicycles and all sorts of machinery and fun, but the real story is the story of Belfast and a city, and how a city can survive in the modern world, and how also, and this is crucial, how we deal with our own history. And that's absolutely fundamental to his work.
Did he ever talk to you about his work, about writing plays, about directing, or indeed did you talk to him?
Of course, yes. And I mean, he died when I was 27. This is infuriating on many levels, but we had really begun to have those proper conversations, and then they just had to stop. And I keep having recourse to the writing and also to this wonderful biography of Marilyn's, where I'm finding out so many things. But yes, his whole take on theatre, and I suppose, if it's not too big a statement, on life, is massively influenced, has massively influenced me.
Geraldo, what are your memories of Stuart Parker?
Well, I suppose they're twofold. On the one hand, there's the presence that you discover through reading and through understanding the achievement of this great playwright. And that sort of came somewhat later. My recollection of him in the Belfast of the 60s probably has more significance for me personally, in that there was a slightly kind of, he was a bit of a dude. There was a kind of a style that he personified, which sat very, very easy with my generation. I may be incorrect here, but as I think of him, I hear a slightly inflected American accent, ever so slightly. This was a man who knew his way around London. He knew his way around America. He was hip. And that was not that general around Belfast of the mid. There was lots of people into it, but they weren't writers. So he kind of was in the advanced guard. And we looked up to him without, as you would never do in Belfast, saying so. That's not the kind of thing you did. The school I went to was a liberal college, as they would say in the States, in Orangefield. And it was run by a wonderful educationalist called, the headmaster was called John Malone, who had a big influence on Stuart Parker. And the kind of ethos that that school tried to generate was an ethos which Stuart embodied. Witty, engaged by and in the world, very, very well read, a wonderful sense of fun. But as Lynn says, behind that, there was a kind of, not seriousness today sounds like somber. It wasn't that. There was a gravitas and an understanding that how you deal with big issues is by a kind of a brightness and a laughter. But that doesn't mean that you exclude them from what you're writing. So, I mean, there's this twofold quality when I think about him. But I did just very briefly meet him when he was at school. He attended Orangefield to give a reading of Sylvia Plath's poems. And we were all doing the A-levels. And it was, again, a kind of advanced thing to have writers in school. He had his soft duncher, his soft hat on, and he was dressed very much part of that time, which went down very well with the lads in the classroom. And he started to read Sylvia Plath's poems. Electrifying.
Remarkable moment.
Absolutely electrifying.
You, in a recent review of Marlene Richtrick's book, you talked about the unmistakable ethical force of Parker's writing. Where do we see that in the plays in particular?
Well, to my mind, there's a crucial and critical centre to Stuart's work, and it's got something to do with how we live our life better, and at the same time respect difference. And there's a shock in his work that people will hurt or offend others because of what they believe in. So that I think the ethical force, the strength of that moral force that's there, is that he wants to get his audience in front of him in the theatre, entertain them, but also to say, I mean, people can be different and live together.
Lynn, would you concur with that?
Absolutely. I mean, the play that most sums that up is Pentecost. And I think he just had a way of understanding human dilemma from every point of view, because in Pentecost, all of the sections of Northern Irish community, class and religious divides are represented. But they boil down to some individuals caught up in this odd situation. And there's this moment where Marion and Lenny are having a row, and Lenny says, "This right here is Nazi Belfast now, and it's us playing the Jews." And Marion says, "God, but you're simple. People cast adrift in hysterics. Spare me your vision of the Third Reich and Ballyhackamore." And it's just that completely sort of almost commonsensical approach, that clear vision. This is just about people and the way they rub up against each other.
And there's also the sense of universal in it.
Yes, exactly.
You can't just reduce it to the local. You directed Pentecost and Spoke Song in Belfast in 2008, marked the 20th anniversary of Stuart Parker's death. I remember seeing those plays, seeing that production, and being very taken by them. And it was my first time to see both plays. There must have been a certain emotional freight for you to take that on at the time.
Well, I directed both of them before, in fact.
I suppose particularly for the anniversary.
Yeah, Spoke Song I directed first just the year after he died, which was even more difficult. And actually, it was great to be able to return to them with that amount of time in between. Yeah, I mean, the job you do is made easy because these plays are so clear, because the writing is so fine, so precise, so beautifully crafted. And that's the other thing. He's a great craftsman.
What kind of response did you get in Belfast to those plays 20 years on?
Complicated, actually. Everybody loved Spoke Song because it is that sort of little glimpse into a part of history that we're now a little bit distanced from. With Pentecost, they were still a bit uptight, to be honest. And I think that it will take a few more years before Belfast may be ready for this. But actually, it is as appropriate now as it ever was, given recent events. And I think the other play that really needs looking at is Northern Star, which looks at the whole trajectory of Northern Ireland in its relation to Ireland as a whole island.
Yeah, terrific play.
Yeah.
You'd also directed a really fine production of Heavenly Bodies in the Peacock in 2004 for the Abbey Centenary. And I remember seeing the Shotgun was playing on the main stage. And I remember the time thinking that actually the more interesting production was downstairs on the smaller space in the Peacock, because Heavenly Bodies is it's a joyous, it's a terrific play.
Well, it's a writer writing about a writer, but Boucicault, of course, was a showman even more than a writer, and The Shachran's a great play. But Stuart wanted to look at this individual as part of a time in theatrical history where the writing was actually being submerged by spectacle. So Boucicault was sort of worried that people weren't going to take him seriously as a writer. And sometimes you think that's a problem that modern writers come up with as well.
Let's hear an extract from Heavenly Bodies. This is Owen Rowe, currently playing King Lear at the Abbey, who was in that 2004 Parker production at the Peacock. Here he's playing the role of Boucicault.
He sprawls out on his ottoman in front of a glowing hearth, snorting into a large cognac. Madame, resplendent in her latest gown, the distinguished guests disposed about the warmly lit room, and outside, in the dark, empty yawn of an indifferent world, you prowl the streets, incapable of rest, dispossessed and starving. You pass and pass and press your face against the window, devouring the picture of them in there, plump with wit and wine, their flesh creamy with pleasure as they breathe in the intoxication of their own fame and power. Power over you and all your kind. You stare in till your eyes are burnt hollow, watching them idly at play upon your name, upon your parentage, at play upon your provincialism, at play upon your play. And all the while, the monstrous ache, the lust you feel to be let in, to burst the muzzle and gorge down the entire room. By Christ, I would cheerfully kill the goat-sucker and eat the floral tributes off his hearse, single-handed.
Owen Rowe there, playing the role of Boucicault from Stuart Parker's play Heavenly Bodies. Dub. Parker, of course, rock critic for the Irish Times in the early 1970s, and some fascinating reviews and columns. High Pop, the book, bringing some of those columns together for us. He was very insightful on the music of his day and loved groups like The Band and Steely Dan, we heard there.
He was on the money. I mean, when the book came out a few years ago now, I mean, one of the things that I remember saying and talking to a younger audience of people into music and so on, this is your playlist. If you want to find out the best of music, not just in the 50s and 60s, but actually going back in time, I mean, Stuart had this wonderful instinct for the best. And I think it's kind of important to say, because sometimes we lose sight of this as well. He was interested in the best, in anything, and he could spot it. I mean, there's so much intelligence at play in High Pop, but what fascinates me, I was just looking through it again, thinking about what I could say today, was just, I mean, the light touch, the light intelligence, and then he spots something. It's the bands that he loved, like The Band or Steely Dan. He was also very alert, and he could hear the music of the single musician, the singer-songwriter, the Joni Mitchells. He was very, very sensitive to woman writing and singer-songwriters who are women. And then he could spot the phonies too, and he was quite aggressive, if you like, when it, someone like John Lennon, for instance, and Lennon's, as he refers to him, I mean, this abominable politics about Ireland. I mean, the phony in art, we don't tend to have many people saying it now, but back then Stuart had an eye, and he could kind of identify it very clearly. I think the other thing too, just when I was listening to Lynn talking about the plays, which strikes me, he was a very democratic, he had a very democratic intelligence, in that he could range through the great literary achievements of our tradition, the Irish tradition, but also he could connect that, you know, Joyce and into other literary cultures as well, as he could with popular music. One of the best introductions to American popular music is high pop. The way in which he could kind of take his reader into an understanding of blues, R&B, jazz, and then suddenly open the panoramic vision, and you were back in the 1920s. I mean, you know, actually inside the studio as he was talking about a recording of a particular artist. It's wonderfully alive. Wonderfully alive.
I also love the description of David Bowie and Mark Bolan as lurid narcissists.
I know. I mean,
it's a great phrase.
It's wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And there are others that he spotted of similar kind of. And there's a wonderful line when he talks about Morrison, where he says they should name a street after Bob Morrison, and he identifies some of the great strengths of Morrison's music. And some of the of earlier days. I mean, he was a talent spotter.
Lynn, thinking of that play Northern Star, and I suppose really Stuart Parker himself could be described as precisely that, as this star that has that burns still, you know, and is there. And, you know, I suppose, again, we've talked in this programme about the Stuart Parker Trust and that great gift of the annual award to a young playwright. I mean, he has left a huge legacy for us all.
It's a huge challenge as well. I mean, he is kind of unique. I mean, there are very few writers with his ability, with the breadth of spectrum and skill and vision. And this is particularly unique in a writer from his background, from the Protestant working class. And he has left a legacy. I think the challenge is still to do the work, because it's not easy work. He's a very demanding writer. He writes a play for a leading middle-aged actor, where he also has to do magic tricks and stuff like that. He's always throwing something at you. The lead in Spoke Song has to be able to ride the unicycle as well. You know, I mean, there are challenges within all of the plays which have to be picked up, but it's really the density of ideas. And I think we're more than ready with the skills we have in this country now to take them on.
I love the TV plays as well. Iris in the Traffic, Ruby in the Rain. I mean, they're lovely. The layering and again, the imagination at work in those plays is so impressive. But we need to see more of the work.
Yes, and I mean, Marilyn's biography is going to set this up into another level. It's an extraordinary piece of, it's a magisterial biography. Not only the radio material, the television, there are interviews that he conducted which should be brought together maybe. There's that wonderful radio programme, The Green Light, a self-portrait. I mean, you're talking about a kind of an extraordinary rich imagination which could break in different directions. And at each direction it broke into, it established its own terrain. So, you know, that's not that common. You know, a writer will concentrate upon one field, comfort as a novelist or as a poet or as a playwright. Sometimes they may move across. But in terms of his technique, Parker could move into different genre and achieve wonderful, wonderful achievement as a playwright for the radio, for the television, for the stage. And that's on all the other stuff.
A voice that we still need to listen to. Thanks to both of you, Lynn Parker and Gerald Daw. And again, Marlon Richterich's biography of Stuart Parker, Stuart Parker Life, is published by Oxford University Press. Incidentally, a number of Stuart Parker's television plays can be seen at the Belfast Film Festival, which opens on April the 11th. And Stuart Parker's plays are published and still available in Methuen Books. Before we go, a word about a new documentary film at the IFI in Dublin tomorrow night. Skin in the Game, directed by Donald Taylor Black, looks at artistic responses to the financial crisis here. That's at 6:30 with a post-show discussion which I'll be chairing with the director, Donald Taylor Black, Roddy Doyle and Brian Maguire. More details on ifi.ie. Tonight's programme was produced by Sarah Binchy. From all of us, good night.
Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods. And you can listen back to that edition on the RTE radio player, available online at rte.ie. And Arts Tonight is repeated on Wednesday mornings at 4 o'clock on Through the Night. And you can podcast it as well from the website, rte.ie/radio1/artstonight.